Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates, episode by episode, the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Corporal Captain Rob Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent once again is Colonel Kevin Lauderdale. Hi, Kevin.
Hey there, how's it going? I love the food. I keep coming for the food. You can eat your gruffle, because if not...
You can eat your fat. So anyway, thank you for coming back. You know I always enjoy talking to you, and I know we're very excited to talk about this episode of MASH.
It's a wacky, crazy episode.
And
the furniture has the best story arc, but we'll talk about that later.
We will, yes. This is, of course, Season 2, Episode 21, Crisis, original air date, February 9th, 1974, written by Larry Gelbart and Lawrence Marks. Man, those guys wrote a lot. And directed by Don Weiss. And, of course, to any comic book fan, the word crisis certainly suggests something that that maybe Kevin and I can talk about later on, but maybe some alternate world versions of MASH, if such a thing's existed. But Henry calls a meeting of the senior staff to announce a major crisis. The 477 supply line has been cut, meaning the unit won't be receiving virtually any of the basic materials they need. Fruit, vegetables, fuel oil, bandages, toilet paper, electrical parts, no mail call, no winter clothing, not even shuttlecocks. Everyone does their part, except for Frank, who hoards a ham for the rest of the unit, sharing it only with Margaret until Hawkeye and Trapper catch them. HQ promises there won't be any wounded either, but of course they're wrong, and then the wounded start arriving in droves. To conserve material so they have them for the wounded, Henry, Radar, Klinger, and Father McKay all have to sleep in the swamp. It's crowded, but everyone gets along, but even more wounded stream in the middle of the night. Afterwards, Henry tries to stress to HQ how desperate the 477th is getting. Everything not nailed down is getting burned for heat, and when you see an example of that, Henry's desk is getting closer and closer to the ground, his office getting emptier and emptier. The next night, they all bunk out at Henry's tent, since it's smaller and requires less heat. Again, overall good cheer presides, at least until the gang discovers that Frank is wearing heated socks and refuses to share. Hawkeye and Trapper try and pull them right off of Frank's feet, causing chaos in Henry's tent. But this tomfoolery is interrupted by even more wounded. During surgery, Radar shows up to announce that the supply truck has just arrived, filled with everything the 477th needs. The crisis has ended. Later, Henry thanks HQ from inside his now completely empty office. Kevin, yeah, this is Crisis.
It says Crisis on Infinite 38th Parallels. Before we dive in, I want to get inside baseball for a minute. I want to talk about the writing credits, which is something I only recently discovered, and I'm going to guess a bunch of our listeners might not know about this either. So if you're scrolling through, say, the Wikipedia page on episodes, and you'll see written by Larry Gelbart and Lawrence Marks, written by later on Ken Levine, Dave Isaacs, sometimes you'll see AND, and sometimes you'll see ampersand.
Right.
This episode is Larry Gelbart ampersand Lawrence Marks. And so I did a little research into this. What that means is for Writers Guild union credits, you are considered a unit. You're considered basically one writer, a team, if you have an ampersand. So you see Gelbart and Marks ampersand all over the place. What that means is they worked together, they wrote a script, they turned it in, whatever. But sometimes you'll see later on something like a credit, Alan Alda, AND Burt Metcalf. And what that means is, for various reasons, one person wrote one part, one person wrote another. So it could be very well be Alan Alda wrote a complete script, and the story editors were like, this is good, but we got to fix the B plot. Let's bring in Burt Metcalf. I mean, in terms of money, it's the same. A writing team gets paid the money, and their, you know, the agent splits it. If it's an and, then each of you gets 50-50. But what's interesting is when things happen, like in the episode Kim, you'll see a credit like Mark Mandel, AND, Gelbart, ampersand Marks. And so what that means is Mark Mandel got half the money, and Gelbart and Marks each got a quarter of the money, because they were considered one writer together. Now, okay, Rob, if you can get Ace Gilroy, the animated series, working, I would love to be a writer on that show. Because do you happen to know what the Writers Guild minimum is currently for a half-hour primetime show, like any episode of a sitcom you might see?
No, I do not.
It's $26,000.
Wow! Oh, man.
If you can get – this is why everybody wants to be a TV writer. It's the hour-long primetime dramas, you know. I think it's 38,000 because it assumes it's a lot more work. No, not that much more. Not twice as much work because you're looking at like 25 minutes versus, you know, 45 minutes. So that's why it's good to be a writer. You can get two or three stories under your belt. You know, pretty soon it adds up. You can buy a podcast network.
There is one available. If there are any TV writers out there that want to purchase a podcast network, I am sure me and the guys would be happy to sell it off. That's amazing. I mean, I have seen those credits, that ampersand and then the A&D, and you always kind of wonder what's that about. And then the one instance I can think of related to that was I remember that is how Franken and Davis ended up on Saturday Night Live because they were so broke that basically NBC said, well, we'll hire you guys, but you have to split one salary.
Yeah.
And they were a comedy team, and so that was within the Writers Guild that was acceptable to do. And even though it meant very little money for Franken and Davis, they took it because they needed the gig. They were so broke, apparently one of them played Winnie the Pooh at the Macy's or something that earlier that Christmas. And, of course, I mean, look what happened to them. I mean, it set their careers in motion at that point. But, yeah, that was – I mean, they basically had to split one salary, which probably in 1975 – was not a lot of money. So that's TV's a good gig. I mean, the one other thing I can think of is I read a piece years ago. I don't even remember who it was, but it was an interview with a TV showrunner who has had like six consecutive failed shows. Like none of his shows get past like half a season. And they were interviewing him from his house. And he was very upfront, and because he talked about that he has a really nice house in Los Angeles with a pool, and he doesn't work a whole lot in terms of how many days he puts in. And he just said, yeah, I'd love to have a hit show, but he said, if this is failure, I'll take it. You know, and I thought that's very – I kind of like that. He was upfront, like, look, this is – that's how lucrative television is, that even if you continually fail at it, you're leading a pretty good life. So, yeah, that's all interesting stuff, Kevin.
Yep. The one other thing I remember is I heard an interview with somebody who was a television director. And apparently the way – what you want to do is you want to direct pilots.
Yes.
The first episode. Because even if you don't direct any more episodes of that show, if that show becomes a hit, if it carries on, you get a cut, an extra – a little something off the top just because you directed the pilot. So if you directed the pilot of, let's say, MASH, and then nothing else for the next 11 years, every episode you get a little
– James Burroughs directed the pilots for Will and Grace, Friends, and Cheers.
It may very well have been that.
Yeah. I mean, and right, and that's just the three off the top of my head. I can't imagine the amount of the checks that are rolling in to that guy's house. I'm just keeping track of it all. So, yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting because Lawrence Marks and Larry Gelbart were not a team as such. You know, I mean, they were – Larry Gelbart was on staff and Lawrence Marks was on staff. But it's kind of interesting that they chose to sort of put themselves together as a team for this episode because they weren't – like you mentioned Ken Levine and David Isaacs who were a writing team who went from show to show.
And what happened later on in the seasons is people, they would just like file story ideas. And I'm not sure. I think we see a lot of things like teleplay by, story by. They would file various story ideas and just sort of shuffle them in. It's like, this will make a good B plot. This will make a good C plot. This will make an A plot. And I'm not sure exactly how people got paid, but I'm sure it worked out okay.
Those guys cranked out a lot of episodes. I mean, virtually every episode of MASHcast, I'm saying it's Gelbart and Marks. Gelbart and Marks in some iteration. And this one is a really, really good one. This is, I'd say this is kind of like a bottle episode in that it's just so centered on the main cast and just the operations of the unit. The first thing I thought of when I was watching this one again, and it's occurred to me before, is how completely inconsistent the weather patterns are in Korea, apparently. Because in the previous episode that we just covered, As You Were, it's warm enough for Henry to be sitting outside in shorts and getting a tan, and now they're in the middle of this Korean winter. So, I mean, Korea must be built on that same material they built the Genesis planet on. I mean, this stuff's just, you know, just, there's no consistency here and there, but they never worried about that stuff on MASH. When one day it was super hot, next day it was super cold.
Oh, yeah. This summer I watched None Like It Hot, and I think like either two episodes before or two episodes after, it's snowing.
Yeah.
It's the hottest night anybody can remember. There's a snowstorm outside.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, hard to dress on the fourth episode. So this episode opens up with a very serious meeting between Radar and Henry as he's talking about that this whole crisis is going to be a test of his leadershipmanship. And he swears off the booze after, of course, he takes one more hit, one more drag off of a drink. And he invites everybody in, and he tells them the situation. And I love the first of all, we see the fourth wall of Henry's office. That's always a detail that I like. I love how Henry is trying to be very serious. He's doing the whole thing about we have to put our shoulder to the wheel, our nose to the grindstone. He's trying to be as much of a leader as he can be. And there's this shot of Hawkeye and Trapper, of course, not buying it entirely. And then there's even a shot of Frank and Hot Lips, who look a little dubious. Like, they're not used to him trying to be like a leader, and I think they're not totally buying it.
I love this episode because this is, in the best sense of the term, Abbott and Costello go to war. This is chuckle after chuckle after chuckle. And I suppose you could say, oh, well, they're performing surgery, so there's some serious things. But this is an episode that just makes me laugh and laugh and laugh. This is also an episode where I would love to have either been on the set, which would have been cool, but also I'd love to do like a pop-up video for this episode because there is so much weird stuff going on in the background. Like, hey, did you notice? Did you notice? Did you notice? Like, we've seen before Henry's office with all of his kids' drawings, but as the episode progresses, the drawings disappear.
Yes, yes.
We're going to find out why. I thought that was a cute little thing. Also, we have the continuing trope of Margaret doing all the talking for Frank. Major Burns thinks this. Major Burns thinks that. Also, Reinformed Regimental says, Trapper who asks, if they can fly in casualties and things like that, why can't they fly in supplies? And Henry says, well, Regimental says there's not going to be any casualties, which doesn't answer Trapper's question.
No. No, it doesn't.
Okay, what does that have to do with not flying in supplies? Henry's – did you see Wayne Rogers losing it in the background?
Yes. I'm going to get to that when we get to my favorite line because it features an amazing laugh by – genuine laugh by Wayne Rogers, which I just love.
Okay. Keep going.
I love it. I love all that stuff. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of actually in this opening scene of Wayne Rogers seemingly really laughing at what's going on. I mean, first of all, they do the thing about the no shuttlecocks. We can't have, the shuttlecocks and Trapper slaps his hands. How are we supposed to fight a war without shuttlecocks or whatever? And that's – I feel like that's something where that's Larry Gilbart and Lawrence Marks just being a little – impish in that the word shuttlecock is, it sounds dirty. It isn't, of course, but it's got a phrase in there that you're not allowed to say on television in any other context.
Right.
You say it in here, shuttlecock, shuttlecock. They say it like three times in 2 seconds.
Take a drink. Here's a drinking game for you. Take a drink every time somebody references something that sounds a little like going to the bathroom.
Yeah.
There's five or six of those in this episode.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I know that Larry Gilbert was constantly dealing with the censors back and forth. There was the episode where they couldn't say that Radar was a virgin. So Larry Gilbert just decided to introduce a soldier from the Virgin Islands just to be a little petty. So, yeah, I feel like that's another one of those kinds of things. Because I mentioned in the couple episodes previous where Radar is writing that letter and he talks about Henry wore his King Neptune costume. And he talks about how it covered everything, including his pelvic region. And they say pelvic region three times in 5 seconds. I feel that's just Larry Gilbart going like, just, sort of chortling to himself. But I love the moment where they say, okay, now we're going to Radar read the list of things that are not coming. And he says, fruits, vegetables, assorted food, yada, yada, yada. And then there's this whole speech where Frank is upset about worrying about that the unit is worried about toilet paper. And so Henry then says, okay, now we're going to go. We're going to go down the list of what things people are going to be in charge of.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts reading the same list. He's like fruit, vegetables, assorted food, and he doesn't realize he's reading the long list. And you look in the background, and you see Wayne Rogers just start to crack up.
Yep, he totally did.
Just looks so genuine. I mean, he must have known it was coming, but it looks completely real.
Well, I don't know. It looks so real that I don't know. It was either I think it may have been an ad lib on McLean Stevenson's part, or is it possible it was actually an error? Because Radar looks a little off, but Wayne Rogers just totally loses it, and there's then a quick cut, as if like he couldn't stop, and like they cut away to a different angle while they continue that speech. I really think that was either an ad-lib by McLean Stevenson or an actual error, because Wayne totally loses. I've never seen it. It's not that funny. It's a funny sequence, but it's not that funny. Or maybe it was the first time they did it or something like that, because he totally loses it.
You're right. There is – I just watched it. You're right. There is like a hard cut. As soon as he starts to really laugh, they cut to Larry Linville at that point.
Yeah. It was like Harvey Korman on the Carol Burnett show.
Yeah.
I mean, He's totally about to lose it. And you can still see when they cut away, he's still, like, still recovering. So I think it's something's going on. It's one of the many strange things.
That's great. I love all this. Wayne Rogers' reaction to this stuff is great. And so, of course, they have the joke about where Radar decides who's going to sleep with who. And then you have Wayne Rogers again with another great line from Trapper John where he's like, Radar, I'd like to speak to you right after the meeting.
That delivery is so deadpan dry. It's like, that is a fantastic line. Also, Trapper is like chewing gum throughout this sequence, and it gives him sort of almost a film noir. I can see it like being the it's like film noir, almost a gangstery tough guy. You know, it's gum, but he's like, yeah, okay, I'm in charge here.
Yeah, just sitting there. And I feel bad for Father Mulcahy because he doesn't get an assignment, and he literally has to say, what's my assignment, Skipper? And Henry has nothing for him, and then he says, you'll be in charge of morale, which is kind of a nothing position, really. And that's really Father Mulcahy's job sort of anyway.
It's always morale. Every time you need something for him to do. Yeah, you're in charge of morale. You're in charge of keeping everybody's spirits up. Thanks a lot. Yeah. You know?
So that's a, you know, Father Mulcahy could do, and later on in later seasons he would get more to do. You know, that's kind of a give the guy something for Pete's sake. So then we cut to a scene of Father Mulcahy doing just that, and he's doing a bingo game in the mess tent, and Burns gets involved, and there's a weird cut in this scene because after Frank objects to Klinger using coffee beans as the game pieces. He starts talking to Father Mulcahy, and Klinger gets up and gets involved. And Frank Burns says, where did you get that mink coat? And Klinger goes, I paid for it myself. Mm-hmm. And then the scene just cuts. Well, that's not a joke. I paid for it myself. That's not a – like that's not anything.
It sort of is. One of my jobs here in this episode is to explain semi-obscure cultural references. The implication is a sugar daddy didn't give it to him. So nice girl would have been given a fur coat by a sugar daddy. He paid for this himself.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's obscure.
It's cultural. There's a couple more I'll be explaining. Do you happen to know if this is like the director's first episode?
This is not Don White. Don White's been doing stuff since the first season.
Okay, because there's a lot of weird cuts in this. There's also a ton of ADR, and I'm just wondering what was going on. Because there's several moments where the devs clearly added afterwards. I just wonder if they were having a lot of technical problems. It's not like this episode was filmed on location either, because you can tell from the backdrops. That's clearly a backdrop. This was not filmed out at the ranch. So there's just a lot of weird stuff going. This is a cursed episode.
And so then we cut to the swamp, and we see Hawkeye and Trapper cutting up magazines. And if you're not watching carefully, it seems kind of strange. You're like, why are they cutting up magazines? Now, obviously, they're cutting up some of the paper to burn because they need to put it in the stove to heat their tent. But you're like, why are they cutting up magazines? And I think you don't really get a good shot, but I get the sense that they are cutting up Hawkeye's nudie magazines and they're cutting out the text. They're leaving the pictures and they're cutting out the text, and that's the stuff they're going to burn before they burn the nude photos. I mean, that's at least the vibe I got from it.
Oh, no. I thought it was toilet paper. Everything is being used as toilet paper.
Oh, okay.
Where's these 8.5 by 11s become 4 by 5s of toilet paper?
Oh, you're right, because they even talk about that, right? Because he starts talking about, what did you do in the war, Daddy? Oh, I was a latrine officer, son. My unit didn't make a move without me. Which, again, inspires Trapper John to have a very genuine-looking laugh response.
And that's the reason why it's dangerous to leave the staples in. It's going to be...
Oh, yes. I'm glad you're here, Kevin. I can't figure out these things on my own, apparently.
Dirty stuff. You're the one who was chastised me when I said Hawkeye and the nurse were going to go make out in the linen closet. You're like, oh, Kevin, you're so naive.
Oh, that's true. So and then we cut back to Henry's office, and here's the beginning of a great running gag, which is there's somebody sneaking into Henry's office and slowly cutting his desk down further and further, bit by bit, as opposed to just taking the whole desk, which is kind of absurd. Why wouldn't you just, if you could break into Henry's office and take his desk, just take the desk. Why would you saw off some of the legs? But I just love that the desk is slow, and all of the objects on Henry's desk are in their same relative position.
Yes. They only take what they need. You take the legs, and this is the setup for a great what is it called? The rule of three for jokes. This is the first time somebody's taken the legs off my desk. Oh my God, they're going to burn the wood for. Okay, that's wild. That's crazy. That's funny. Moving on.
Right. And then he says, Henry says, we'll take an order. And he says, we don't have any paper. And he goes, well, they burn that too. And he says, well, not right off. So yeah, you're right. There's a lot of potty humor in this, in this episode. And then we have a great moment with Jeff Maxwell, who, of course, is the co-host of the MASH Matters podcast, which is going on right now, where he's warming his hands. I think he's with Dennis Troy, the corpsman, over some burning wood. And Byrne says, where did you get that? And Igor says, my sister sent it to me, sir. And Frank buys it. And walks away, and then you get a little moment of Igor looking at the other guy, just kind of like, can you believe we got away with that? Which is probably the only piece of self-actualization we ever got from Igor.
That's my second favorite line, my sister sent it to me, which, for our younger people, it's like a World War II reference, where or even the Korean War, where your sister would send you a cake or a sweater she knitted. Or if you've been to Katz's Delicatessen in New York, you see the big sign, send a salami to your boy in the army. And I think salamis do show up in the mail in a couple of episodes. So it's like the most obscure things your sister would send you, wood to burn.
I did not know that was a reference. I just thought he was just trying to make an excuse as to how we got some wood. He's like, oh, somebody sent it to me. I had no idea that was an actual reference to anything. That's amazing.
Yep. Is this written by Gilbert? Gilbert was in Korea, I think with Bob Hope, I think we've talked about.
Right. The Hot Lips, Hot Breath Houlihan.
That's right, yeah. So he'd been around Korea. I don't know if he's old enough for World War II, but he must have seen or been exposed to a lot of World War II references. Yeah, that's a very World War II thing.
Wow. Oh, that's cool. So then we have Frank and Hot Lips in their tent, in Margaret's tent. And I love Margaret's her weird skin tight hoodie face mask thing that she's got that runs under her chin. It's incredibly unflattering just to have her face poking out, but it doesn't matter. And of course, that's when Frank has talked about that he has absconded with a ham, and they start diving into it, and they do this self-justifying thing where. You know, they talk about, yeah, we're hoarding, but Frank is like, well, we need to have some strong people in the unit, and we're the strong, so we have to stay strong, and we have to be strong for the weak. And it's, you know, very typical of Frank Burns that he's so patriotic, he's so gung-ho, but when the chips are down, he thinks only of himself, and he's completely okay with wasting and hoarding, not only that, but electrical power, as we find out later with the Sox. But it's like, for a guy that talks a good game, he's obviously completely full of shit.
Yeah. Margaret's balaclava brings up another weird thing that I want to know about, which is she sounds like, from here on out, she has a cold.
Right. And I've got that slightly pitched voice kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm wondering if she really did, and if they put the balaclava on, not only because it's quote-unquote funny, but because that might be a reason why she sounds the way she does.
Hmm.
Because it sounds like she has a cold. It's one of the weirdest things. I wish I was on the set. If I was a pop-up video, I'd be like, beep, beep, does she have a cold? Well, that's why the balaclava is on. I mean, it's in every scene from here on out. It's not just in that one scene. Oh, she's cold. She's wearing it. I want to know what's going on.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't even think about that. She does. I like her, that voice that she puts on. So then, because Hawkeye and Trapper come in, and they realize, hey, you got to turn off this hot plate. And then I love that while Trapper is talking, you see Hawkeye start going like sniffing, and then his line, has somebody been operating on a pig in here?
Lumpectomy.
I love that line. That's fantastic. And you know, and then Trap, do you smell it? And they're all hiding and stuff, and of course they get caught. He says we are interrupted a lumpectomy, which is a great line. And you know, they get caught, and of course Frank completely folds, and he says, I'm deeply ashamed. But of course, he's not really deeply ashamed. He'd do it again in a second, as long as he didn't get caught. But I mean, we realize that Frank is a complete and utter phony all the time. Even when he's acting slightly chuffed, he doesn't really mean it. So, and I kind of like that Hawkeye and Trapper know that they can sort of use that to their own ends. They can kind of like guilt Frank a little, and they get very serious. And you see Wayne Rogers kind of furrow his brow a little, and he talks about, we're going to have to put this ham. We'll have to come go back to whence it came. And he says, we'll never discuss this again. And they're kind of like not letting him off the hook, even though they could. But I really like that they're kind of like, hey, we can use this to our advantage and also torture Frank a little bit.
Yeah, they're going to blackmail him. They want small amounts of bills for months for the rest of the war.
Yeah, I like that. That's great. And he says, you're very gracious. Say no more, man. Frank will expect $100 every Tuesday.
Yeah.
Small bills unmarked in a plain envelope. And they, of course, take the pig with them. And then we go to the scene in the swamp where everybody is having to bunk in there and all the bedpans. Oh, excuse me. I'm watching Hawkeye puts a heating bottle in a bedpan. It's made me think bedpans. All the beds are in there. And, you know, we've made mention in a lot of episodes of the strong connection that Alan Alda personally has to Groucho Marx and Hawkeye's style. This is right out of Night of the Opera. Mm-hmm. Night of the Opera. It's completely
people in that room at one point.
Yeah.
It's insane. Also, here's another fun historical fact. Frank comes in. And Hawkeye goes, oh, Jesus, a house dick. And for our younger listeners, house dick, house detective, hotels and motels used to employ somebody called the house detective. And ostensibly they were there to, you know, keep an eye on things in case there were low-level crimes or whatever. But mostly they were there to police the morals of the establishment. Lest an unmarried couple check in or a man check in and then try to sneak a girl up. For those of you who are in our age or a little bit closer, there's an episode of Fawlty Towers where a guy has got trying to sneak his girlfriend into the hotel, and Basil Fawlty is playing the role of the house dick trying to prevent this from happening. It was a really big thing. And there's a whole bunch of 30s and 40s movies centered around the plot of somebody trying to sneak a member of the opposite sex into a hotel room and the house detective trying to stop it.
I can think of at least two other episodes of MASH where they mention house dicks.
Yeah.
There's one where they talk about where Henry is and he's like he's doing something and then he says and dodging hotel dicks.
Yeah.
And then there's another one where somebody there's another one about – I can think of the line, but I can't think of what the context is. But there's another one where they talk about house dicks. So, yeah, and that was something that, you know, when I was a kid growing up, I only knew the phrase dick to, you know, in a specific way. Like, oh, well, my – and I was always like, you can say that on television? And then it sort of dawned on me from the context. I was like, okay, there must be another meaning to this that I don't fully understand because I know you can't say that on TV.
Yep.
So again, we have Klinger shows up and he's in his outfit and he's putting on his cream de mint face cream, which Frank has absolutely no time for. I do like there's this bit where when Father Mulcahy, who of course is endlessly chipper, and he says, "It looks like I'm going to hit the old sack," and you hear Trapper go, or, you know, Roger, Father, and he's just kind of rolling his eyes a little bit at Father Mulcahy's completely chipper attitude, which is, it's not, I mean, you know, you always want to be nice to Father Mulcahy because he's such a sweet character, but I kind of like that these characters have these little rough edges a little. I like that Trapper's irritated by that. That's a nice little detail.
Yeah, Trapper in particular seems to not be enjoying this as much as everybody else does. Maybe it's because of his position. One of the bits I like the best is Henry's cigar. He comes in, he's got a cigar in his mouth, settles down to go to sleep, puts a cigar in like a shaving mug.
Yeah, yeah.
And when he has to get up to go to the bathroom, another bathroom, he takes the cigar with him. I'm just reminded of when my dogs have to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. The first thing I do is I have to let them out. So I have my iPod right next to me. So like first thing I do is the equivalent of my cigar. I pop my iPod in and I listen to like 2 minutes of whatever podcast I'm listening to when I go first. Let the dogs bring it back in, turn the iPod off, put it down. And this bit also features a lot of Henry ADR, almost everything he says.
Yes,
it's really obvious. And I just really wonder what was going on.
The line about could keep the brass monkeys in tonight and stuff like that.
I mean, wow, I was going to ask about that. Talk about a line about that pushes the – I mean, as far as I know, brass monkeys only means one thing. And talk about something that pushes standards and practices.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they let that one in. I mean, that's –
Do you want to explain what that is?
I believe it's a reference to testicles.
Yeah, it's what I thought it meant.
The only reference I know.
Yeah, Yeah, I don't know. Maybe some of these references were so old, even the censors didn't get them or anything like that. Maybe they're just like, I don't know what that means. Okay, it's fine. I do like that when Henry goes out to go to the bathroom, he grabs what looks like a Reader's Digest out of Frank's. There's like a little box by the door, and he just grabs that. It's like, it's just so much bathroom humor in this episode. It's kind of amazing.
I saw that, and at first I just thought, oh, well, it's there for you going to the bathroom. But you may be right. It may simply be a copy of Reader's Digest on Frank's shelf.
Yeah.
And Frank may suddenly tomorrow turn through the pages and go, where's humor in uniform? And the pages have been torn out.
This just sort of occurs to me as a joke they could have done, but they never could have gotten away with, is if they had grabbed Frank's Bible.
Oh,
the show would have been shut down at that point if they had done that. But, I mean, if you're going to take it to its logical conclusion, because, of course, Radar talks about that they're breaking into the fortune cookies. They're so desperate. So, I mean, come on.
Two things. Number one, that's my favorite line. They're breaking into the fortune cookies to use the paper. That's insane. It's so small. But speaking of Bibles, is it this scene or the next one where Father Mulcahy's Bible or his cross is poking Radar, and so he reaches behind and pulls. It's the cross that's on his Bible. Does that mean Father Mulcahy is sleeping with his Bible like tucked against his back?
I guess so.
That's a weird line. I would have rewritten that line or restructured it somehow because the implication is very odd. He sleeps on his Bible or something like that.
Anyway, I never really thought of it, but yeah,
Bible paper is too thin anyway. Let's face it.
Well, that's a good point. And he has a good scene where he does the prayer, the funny prayer about bag of peanuts. And if I die before I wake, give them to my brother Jake, which of course cracks everybody up. And then Wounded arrives, and they all have to get up. And I love Alan Alda's deadpan. I knew this was all too good to last.
For folks at home, go back and watch after when Father Mulcahy does his prayer. Watch Frank, who is clearly in focus just behind him. And when he gets to the end, Frank's mouth just sort of hangs open. Huh? Weird. It's a weird reaction. But it's a good reminder. Humor too is one of his creations. So.
That's right. That's right. So we go back to Henry's office, and now the desk is just the top. all the drawers are gone. All the material is gone. I love that whoever did that left his little doll. It's still sitting there. And there's a moment. This is here where he's talking to somebody in HQ, and he's talking about fuel, rations. Newspaper is selling for $1 a page. $1 a page. And, you know, he's trying to get HQ to Stars and Stripes, and then we get our hands on, right? And I love, he says, look, buddy, what do you say you get that on the stick there, huh? And in this moment, I wonder if, because we've heard about, you know, anybody who's has watched TV or movies over more than a year or two knows that often when you film a character doing a phone call, there isn't anybody on the other line. That's just an actor just doing their lines. But McLean Stevenson's performance here on the phone call is so good because he's got these ums and pauses, and he starts to talk, and you get the sense that there is somebody interrupting him, that I really think there had to have been somebody on the other end of that line because it sounds completely genuine, like a real phone call you'd have with somebody who is interrupting you and you're trying to get across something to them.
If it's not – I have to say, listening to this podcast and going back and rewatching these first couple of years, I am liking McLean Stevenson more and more.
Oh, yeah.
I was never a huge fan. I always just sort of wrote him off. But I am liking his performances and the occasional subtleties more and more. I really think he got sort of a raw deal with the show he left for Hello, Larry or whatever. I wish he'd been able to come back and do something else. Okay, and for those of you following story structure, this is part two of the Rule of Three involving his desk. And you think it's gone as far as it can go.
Right.
Okay, it's just the top now. It's all gone. All the pictures, I feel sorry for his kids' pictures, which must have been used as toilet paper. The pictures are gone. The desk is down to just the desk. That's funny. They took all of it. That's a good joke. Ha ha ha. Little do you know that this is the rule of three.
Yeah, they're not done with it yet. So yeah, I mean, it's great. I love that, and I love his whole line about I bought a bunch of war bonds, and you were talking to a very upset stockholder,
major investor in the war,
major investor in the war. So now again, they're back at surgery, and everybody's really frustrating. And Frank has the line about this place ought to be called Benedict Arnold Hospital, and he's like, oh look, Hawk, Frank made a joke, and he's like, they get a sick opinion on that. And then we cut to Father Mulcahy singing, singing Comrades ever since we were boys. He's got a nice voice. Mm-hmm. There's this great moment where one of the enlisted turns away and looks at another guy and just shakes his head like, oh, God, is this what passes for entertainment around here, I guess? He just finds that this is, not, you know, if Mulcahy is trying to raise morale, he's not doing the best job in the world.
He's only got so much to work with.
Yeah. And then, of course, we see Hawkeye and Trapper at the bulletin board. Once again, there is a bra pinned to the bulletin board. That is an ongoing joke on MASH. There is some nurse who is constantly, or nurses, constantly putting their bras on the bulletin board. And if I want to come up with an in-story reason as to why this is happening, mm-hmm. I'm going to say that the different nurses are putting their laundry out on the line to dry, and the strong Korean winds are once in a while absconding with a pair of undergarments, and then they're found on the ground of the camp, and somebody's like, well, I don't know whose they are, and then they put them up to the bulletin board. Basically, it's kind of a lost and found.
If this were the MASH Minute by Minute podcast, I'd go back and check to see if it was the same bra, but it's not. I can't tell. Is it the same bra? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I don't think, it's a pretty big bra, too. I mean, I got to say, whoever is the owner of that bra, she's a fairly pneumatic nurse as things go. So then they all set up in Henry's tent because he said it's less heat, and he's fine with that. And that starts the whole thing with Henry and Burns and his hunting socks. And, you know, we already established that Frank is not smart. We already know this. But he doesn't seem to have even some base-level intelligence, because what tips Hawkeye and Trapper off to the hunting socks is that he is sleeping without a blanket. And Hawkeye and Trapper say, why don't you have a blanket? And Burns says, none of your beeswax, which of course is not going to throw them off the trail. And it's because he's warm with the hunting socks. But I mean, he's alerting people to the fact that he's unnaturally warm. It's like if you were trying to hide the fact that you had hunting socks or any sort of like electrical undergarment, I think you would put a blanket on to pretend that you were just as cold as the rest of them. But said, Frank's not that bright.
I was fascinated by the idea of electric battery hunting socks. I remember seeing this episode and going, that is a wild idea. And I think later on I found that you could get them through L.L. Bean. I never got around to them, but this idea, I do not know why it captivated me so much. It's like socks with like a little 9-volt battery in my imagination, wires running through them with a little garter holding it in place. It's like, that's got to be the greatest thing in the world.
They're probably very comfortable. It does seem like a fire hazard, I have to say. Like wool socks that are being heated by an electrical wire, especially 1950s technology, seems kind of grim. And then once again, after Klinger gets thrown out of the nurse's tent, which features, again, it's more ADR, but it's a good ADR joke,
yeah,
where she says to the nurses, I intend to commend you, to put you in for commendations, those of you who have reacted in the most Yankee Doodle-est manner. And they all say, good night, Major. And then you have the ADR of Jamie Farr, good night, Major. And just, you know, Klinger, get that. I love the idea that he managed to, like, hide in Margaret's tent. Like, her tent's not that big, but he's just blending into the background or something.
I'm amazed at how big these tents are. I know that during the one in the swamp where there's seven people, they've clearly just rearranged a few things. Right. And it's still as far off onto one side. Once again, Margaret has her own tent, which always amazes me, and it's positively huge if she can fit seven or eight more nurses in there. Henry's tent, he's a commander, so of course he has his own, but again, you can still fit six or seven people in there. Although Frank is – that's a really good joke. There wasn't quite enough room, so they had to put Frank in a naval –
He's in a hammock.
He's in a hammock, which leads to a Navy joke.
Oh, that's right. Right. Yeah, there's another great joke where it's swaying back and forth. And yeah. Hawkeye says, what time is this tent stopping at Ellis Island, which is great. Yeah. That's a good gag. I love, again, another toilet paper joke is that as Henry is leaving to go to the bathroom again, he grabs one of his children's crayon drawings. And I love that McLean Stevenson actually gives it a slight pause when he looks at it. Like, he's like, am I really going to use this? And then he's like, yeah, I am. And then he walks out of the tent. But I love that he just looks at it for a second. He thinks about it for a second.
Yeah, a subtle acting choice. Go McLean Stevenson.
Yeah, it's one of those things you learn. And I learned this over years of watching television, that it's just because someone wasn't awesome in other things doesn't mean they weren't awesome in something. And I'd say this is a lesson we would all learn about Shelley Long. which Ryan will get to over on Cheers Cast. But it's like, just because Shelley Long didn't have a great movie career doesn't mean that she wasn't absolutely gangbusters on Cheers. And that's the thing with McLean Stevenson. McLean Stevenson, and we'll get to this, of course, later on, because, I mean, his character is going to, spoiler alert, leave the series at the end of next season. But, I mean, just because basically everything McLean Stevenson did after MASH really wasn't very good, with some minor exceptions, it doesn't mean he wasn't great here. And he was. He was tremendous on this show. He was very, very funny, could carry the drama when he needed to. So he really, I'm glad that, one of the purposes of doing this show, not only just to honor the MASH in general, but just to really kind of analyze some stuff you might gloss over. And as I said, both him and Wayne Rogers are just really, really good on this. And so it's kind of fun to see that. And again, this one's a particularly good Henry episode. So after they pull off Frank's socks, which things just get really savage. Like they really, and there's a point where Trapper pulls one of them off, and then there's a fight ensues, and he actually gets pushed over and falls over to the side. Again, that feels a bit like an ad lib kind of, because things are just sort of messy. And you see Wayne Rogers start to laugh when he lands on top of Radar. And then there's one more surgery scene where all the stuff is finally arrived, and they talk about hot dogs, hamburgers, the whole schmear. Everything is great, and it sounds good. Sounds good. I mean, if you're really hungry, it sounds really good to get to deliver all these hot dogs and hamburgers and the whole thing.
And standing next to a very tall nurse.
Oh, really? I didn't even really notice that.
Gary Berkoff is particularly short, and the nurse.
Oh, she is tall. Oh my goodness, you're right.
Tall. It's like, that's an interesting choice right there. It's like
she's like a full foot taller than he is. Look at that. Oh my god. How have I never noticed that before?
You know, I recognize her face. She's one of the standard Abel, Baker, Charlie.
Yeah.
One of the ABC nurses. I can recognize her eyes. But that's an interestingly framed shot with, like, damn.
God, yeah. She's huge. My goodness. I can't believe I've never noticed that all these years. I've seen this episode. I'm focusing on Radar, of course, but that's a very interesting choice to have an actress that tall there. So anyway, he delivers the good news, and then Henry's a good leader, where he says, all right, everybody, calm down. That stuff will all be waiting for us. Let's get back to work. And that ends the scene. And then, of course, the entire episode ends with one of the great buttons in MASH history. So, Kevin, why don't you explain how this episode wraps up?
There's a close-up of Henry on the phone. He's talking to Regimental. He's saying, thank you very much for all the stuff. I really appreciate it.
You guys saved our lives.
You guys did a fantastic job. And the camera slowly pulls out. But you got to realize, like, everything got burned. I mean, everything. I'm talking to you from – and an echo effect begins. I'm talking to you from a great deal of nothing. And his office is empty except for the skeleton. So they
skeleton, yeah.
Everything. They took his entire desk. You thought they took the legs? That's funny. You thought when they took the drawers and stuff, there was just the top? That's funny. But no, rule of three. They took everything except the skeleton. And it's just with a great – like I said, the furniture has the best story arc. That is unexpected and yet perfectly synced with what we've seen earlier. That is beautiful comedy, and it's so funny. And the little echo effect, the hollowness of his office really caps it. It's beautiful.
I do love the ADR and that they jimmy it a little, that the echo is much bigger than it really would be. And when he says, I'm talking to you from deep inside a real big empty, and there's this – the echo is much too severe for what it really would be, but it just puts the comedy across. And it's a wonderfully framed shot. I have to, again, give credit to Don Weiss, the director, for framing it so perfectly. Is that it's – you know, it's that big close-up of Clayne Stevenson and then a slow pullback as things just get more and more. And you realize there is literally nothing left except for the medical skeleton and Henry's chair and the phone, and that is it. It's really one of the whoever, I mean, we have to assume it's Gilbart and Marx. You don't necessarily know. It could have been one of the staff writers, but that's one of those things where you're like, how are we going to end this one? And then you think that up and you go, all right, let's go to lunch now. Like, we've really done a good job. Let's wrap this up. Cause it's really one of the funniest endings of any MASH episode.
I agree. It's a beautiful, beautiful ending.
Yeah, it's great. It's Crisis. It's a really fun episode. Before we were recording, Kevin and I talked about you could have done some, you know, what would a MASH Crisis on Infinite Earths kind of thing be? And my suggestion was the General Bartford Hamilton Steele, played by Harry Morgan, could meet Colonel Potter, played by Harry Morgan. So that was my idea for that kind of cross-world thing that might have happened in MASH.
Yeah, I said horny radar versus super naive radar.
Yes, there you go.
Movie meets the early one from the early ones from the early episodes. Yeah,
that would have been really cool. Yeah, it said it's that if you're a comic geek, the word crisis has basically one connotation in your mind. I mean, it's a word in the English language, and DC Comics doesn't own it, but for people of a certain age, you just hear crisis, and you just think, oh, okay, on where? What earth are we talking about now? So I always made that connection when I was a kid. It's like, oh yeah, that's that word that I'm so familiar with. So, and it's great because this
must be Earth 38.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly.
Oh my God, I can envision the cover. Hawkeye on his knees, holding in his arms like a pietà, the crumpled body of Colonel Blake.
Oh God. Jeez, Kevin, that's kind of a dark way to end the show, but yeah, it's accurate. So yeah, it's Crisis. It's a really, really good episode. It's one of, I mean, I've already been saying, I think there's no bad episodes of season two, but this is, I would say, even within season two, a highlight. Bottle shows can be really good if you do them right, and this is a really good bottle show. It's just very focused on what it's like to be in the unit and the trouble that can happen. And it's just, you know, very, very funny. It's very specific to war. I always like those episodes that, you know, couldn't really be done in a lot of other shows because of the setting. So it's a really classic episode. So Kevin, thank you once again for stopping by. You know, I love talking to you, and this was just great.
I love being on the show, and this is one of those episodes I put on. I just sit there, I just giggle straight through. There's no heavy drama. There's no political point to be made. It's just laugh after laugh after laugh. Funny one-liners, funny two-liners. It's a great episode. I recommend it highly.
It is. So why don't you tell people where they can find you on the internets?
Go to kevinlauderdale.livejournal.com. Yes, that's me. and I'm also on Facebook. I'm Kevin Lauderdale. I'm the guy wearing the sunglasses in the picture. It's a great picture of me. It was taken in Warsaw about 3 years ago. We were on summer vacation staying with some friends, and we were at a cafe, and the sun was bright. I had my sunglasses on. My wife said, come on, take a picture. So I took a picture, and it's like, I look badass in that picture. So I'm the guy with the sunglasses. I look a little like – I fancy myself. I look a little like the character of Shades in That Thing You Do. When I was younger, I looked a little like a young Tom Hanks, I fancy. But anyway.
Okay. All right. We'll take it. That's sure. We'll buy it. There's no problem there. So, yes, of course, if you want to listen to back episodes of MASHcast, go to the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we're also – you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts and on Stitcher. We're always talking MASH over on Twitter, which is at MASH477Cast. I mentioned earlier that Jeff Maxwell has a co-host a show called MASH Matters, which is our podcast in law. He referred to this show as a podcast in law, which is a phrase I really like. So if you're not subscribed to that show, you should listen to that show. It's a lot of fun. It's not an episode-by-episode show. It's more of just their thoughts on the thematic ideas behind MASH and stuff like that. And it's a really, really fun show. I listen to it. I very much enjoy it. And we have talked about some sort of podcast team-up. Speaking of crisis, we have talked about some sort of MASH Matters, MASHcast team-up at some point. So that'll hopefully be something we get to do sooner rather than later. And then the last thing I need to mention, of course, as we all know, the Fire and Water Podcast Network has a Patreon. You can go and contribute over at patreon.com/FW Podcast, and you can make a one-time donation or an ongoing monthly donation. And one of the rewards you can get is to be mentioned on any show on the network of your choice. So I have to thank some people that chose MASHcast to be mentioned on. So big thanks to Adam Sanders, Nicholas Prom, and Suzanne Holland. Thank you so much for your contributions and helping keep the lights on, which is actually really thematically perfect for this episode of MASH. Thank you all for supporting MASHcast. So that is going to do it. Once again, Kevin, thanks so much. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that is all.
This entire unit should go on immediate red alert.
Now that makes good sense. I would make it conditional, however.
On what?
On what does red alert mean?